topic, we're in week 7, so we have a few more seminars to go. And as we approach the end of the course, it gets a bit more detailed. We go get in more detail, and we end with the last week, which will actually be on the final things you have to do in your dissertation, which is about proofreading and editing and so on. But today we'll be focusing on developing your academic style. So academic style is something that, you know, there's a lot of books written about academic style, and also there's a lot of disagreement in the literature on what constitutes a good academic style. And academic style also depends very much on your discipline. If you read an article about, you know, in mathematics, for example, it will have a very different style of presenting the argument than an article in education or another social science. So of course, if you're interested in this topic, to kind of get behind the theory of in this topic, I did add in the notes I will send to everyone at the end of today, I add the short reading list so you can compare and contrast different styles in different disciplines. But today we'll be focusing on kind of the main principles of academic style that apply to everyone, regardless of whether you're doing a dissertation in a social science or an exact science. And we're going to, we'll be looking at those main aspects of academic style. Also, when you do your readings, when you read your articles and books, sometimes you read something and you really enjoy reading it, and other times you find it a bit complicated to understand the reading. And I have to say, although academics like to write about style, and style is something that is marked in academic essays and dissertations, it's part of the marking criteria that we'll see a bit later in one of the slides. In reality, some of the articles and books out there don't necessarily respect all those rules of style. So style is something that there are some general principles about that we'll discuss today, but it's also down to each author, each writer, to adapt the style depending on their discipline and their topic. So in this seminar will be, so the key learning outcome, we have a learning outcome in each of those classes, is to developing a clear and economical academic writing style. And by that, I mean that everyone, you know, each of us here in this group have written quite a range of different work before. We all written a lot of essays. Perhaps some of you wrote blogs or maybe other forms of writing. And everyone has already started developing a writing style. But the idea of today is to look, you know, to reflect on your style at the moment, how it is, and think about how to make it clearer and how to make it more economical. And I will explain what that means in a minute. It has to do with things like avoiding repetition, things like making sure you don't include overly long words. If you can have a shorter word instead, and making sure that your writing is not too vague or too complex, especially when you think about fitting in a certain word count, especially if you struggle with the word count. So as usual in those seminars, we'll start with some group reflections on the home exercise, and I will give a couple of examples from you. And if you had the chance to do it, to do the home exercise, that's good, because you can, you know, you can comment directly on those texts. But if not, we'll start with some, as always, some general questions about style that everyone can contribute and have an answer to. Then we'll go on to the theory. So I kind of categorized some common mistakes that markers see in academic style when they have that tick box about style and in the marking criteria. And then we'll have a discussion about how to choose the right style for your text. And we'll look at how different parts of the dissertation may have different requirements in terms of style. Then there are some questions, some reflection questions that are adapted from Orwell, who's an English writer, essayist, and who wrote a lot on style, on writing style in general, mainly about political writing, but also a lot of those, you know, this writing applies to all types of writing in general, in terms of general principles of style. And we'll end, as usual, the theory part with some key tips to think about in terms of improving your style in the future. And then we'll move on to the demonstrations. So there, as usual, we try to show different software you can use. There's this software called Ref and Write. So I will show a bit about how that looks like, but we'll focus on phrase banks, because a lot of students, when I have office hours or speak to students about their writing style, especially, you know, as myself, I came here as an international student, like we often struggle with selecting the right phrases and the right way to put into words what we want to say, especially if you think about more formal expressions, like how to introduce disagreement, how to have different connecting words in your paragraphs, or how to, you know, standard type of formulations that are used in academic writing. And phrase banks are something that's very useful for that. So we'll look at the software. That's a software you can access some of the things for free, but some of them it's a paid software. But we'll also look at the phrase bank that is publicly available from one university, and many universities have those websites. It's quite difficult sometimes to find them, but I will show you one example that you can use. And then we will focus on a dissertation. Actually, I'm not sure why I wrote their essay. It's again a dissertation, a master's dissertation, and we'll focus on the writing style, and we'll look at something that's very important that sets the style of the dissertation, and we'll zoom on the abstract and the structure of the abstract, but as well as the style of the abstract, and comment on some of the ideas that we discuss today. And then, as always, questions and discussions, and as usual, feel free to jump in, raise your hand, or put your comments on the chat. Okay, so just a reminder for everyone, the home exercise for today had two parts. One part was thinking about selecting one piece of writing from an academic article or book that you are reading at the moment, and one piece of writing from a non-academic reading, and thinking about what are the main differences in those academic compared to non-academic style, and thinking about this question of what actually makes an academic style. And the second part, I provided a very short text from a book that I will have on the next slide that we can look at again, thinking about what is good, what's positive in this type of style, and perhaps if you can find any way to improve this style. So yeah, let's share some general comments first about the exercise. So even if you haven't managed to do it, and I'm aware that quite a few of you have imminent deadlines in your work, but let's start with this kind of first broader question of what differentiates an academic from a non-academic style. And you don't have, I mean, if you didn't do the exercise, that's fine, because of course you know, everyone is reading academic work for their courses now, but we also read non-academic work, like, you know, novels or newspaper articles or other forms of non-academic writing. So thinking about what differentiates those two styles. And then another question that applies to everyone, regardless of whether you have done or not the examples in the exercise, is when you write your essay or your dissertation in most of your cases, how do you approach this element of writing style? You know, when you write, what things do you consider? Do you consider things like clarity? Do you reflect on certain aspects of style? Or have you adopted a style perhaps from your earlier years in university, or perhaps in college or in school, and you kind of adapted the same style and just improved on the vocabulary or the content without necessarily thinking too much about adapting the academic style? So yeah, really, what are your thoughts on that, and what kind of challenges you face when you're writing your academic work in terms of style? And for those who did manage to do the exercise for today, if you want to share any kind of examples that you thought were interesting, and you know, any thoughts on the second part of the exercise, which was one text. But if you, we can focus on the first two questions, and then I will show you some examples anyways for everyone to see, regardless of whether you did or not the exercise for today. So who would like to get started perhaps on the first two questions, just sharing some ideas on the differences between academic and non-academic style, and how do you approach style in your own writing? Does anyone want to start on this? Just some general thoughts on this topic. I'm going to check the, yeah, you can raise your hand or, yeah, just jump in. Yeah, Gina, please.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. What I have noticed from my previous experience in academic writing is in academic writing, I think terminology matters more than it does in non-academic writings. For example, well, as a non-native English speakers, I sometimes have a problem with certain terminology that has different connotations, which leads to unclarity of my writings. So, in writing academic styles, I try to be careful of selecting terminology, even if it's used widely.
Yeah, that's a good point. So the specific vocabulary that's specific to your topic, and that counts much more in academic style of how you accurately use those terms. And yes, it's challenging to understand. You have to obviously understand those terms in the first place, but how to use those terms in the text is a different question. So that's a good point that we'll return to later on when we look at different elements of style as well. So thank you for that contribution, Gina. Anyone else wants to share their experience and challenges with academic style? Yonso, please.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
For me, academic writing is more subject, I don't know how can I say. The authors usually try to avoid the first person, so they don't really use I or we, and also they try to put a lot of signposting. So, however, therefore, those kind of words enhance the logical flow of the whole writing. So I think that's kind of outstanding point of academic writing.
Yeah, that's a very good point about all those connecting words, more formal words like however, furthermore, and so on, that's used to connect sentences. Whereas in, when we speak to our friends, or even, when you read novels or newspapers or magazines and so on, those words tend to not to be used as much or at all, even in our daily conversations or in non-academic and non-formal writing. So yes, we'll actually have a slide that includes that point as well on how to make your language a bit more formal as well in your writing. Any other comments on this before we move on to the examples? Okay, so there's nothing on the chat. So let's move on to some, just a few examples from you. We already covered a couple of those points, and I think, I mean, this is a very, I like this example because it's, it's very nice kind of comparing this academic writing on one hand and one piece of writing from a non-academic source. And I think this really, I mean, this answer really covered the key differences in non-academic and academic writing, which is different elements of style, of how formal the style is, what kind of voice you use in the style. So this is the whole issue around what kind of pronouns you use, but also what kind of voice in terms of do you use more a passive voice or an active voice, and that's something that we are going to discuss later. Then yes, this very important point that was mentioned as well about signposting and logical order. And I think that's very, very interesting because often in academic, non-academic writing, the arguments will be ordered in different way, whereas academic writing tends to follow a more rigid structure in terms of logically ordering arguments. I mean, it doesn't mean that, for example, when you read especially a longer opinion piece or newspaper piece, it doesn't mean that it can't have a logical argument, but it's structured usually in a different way with fewer conventions of writing and fewer formal conventions. And let's look now, maybe we can look at an example from the text for those who didn't have a chance to do the exercise. So this is just one paragraph that you can see on the screen. One paragraph from an academic source. And I will read, you can have a look at it. Maybe I'll read through like the first few sentences, and then you can let me know perhaps what you think about this and whether you like this style, you think that style is clear, it's easy to follow, or whether you can identify any kind of areas of improvement in the style. So this is the text goes on. So this is the start of the paragraph saying, this is the story of the most significant new British political party in a generation. New parties are founded all the time, but most are tiny clusters of discontents bound together by a single marginal issue. Most wither and die very quickly. Others, like the nationalists in Scotland and Wales, have changed the face of politics in their nations, but by its nature, their appeal is geographically limited. They could not change the balance of power in Britain as a whole, nor did they aim to do so. So just from those first few sentences, and having a look at this, you know, it's one paragraph. What do you think about this? What do you think about the style? Is it easy to read? Is it captivating? Does it draw your attention to read further? And if not, what are the things that could be improved, do you think, in this paragraph? So I'll leave maybe like a few more seconds so you can have a read through this. And yeah, feel free to start commenting when you're ready. Okay, I'm opening the chat. So Gina is saying, it's easy to follow and entertaining start, but I feel it is less academic. Yeah, it's an interesting comment because it's actually one of those academic books that's not necessarily very conventional. It's an academic book that appeared originally as an academic book, but it had quite a lot of popularity in the sense that it was read by the wider public, not only by scholars or students or people within universities. So that's a good observation. Anyone else wants to comment on what they think about the style? So what?
Alexandra, sorry.
No worries. Go on.
Yeah. So I was like, I could not really tell, like, what exactly is not academic, but I do feel that at the beginning, for example, it's like most. The author used the most words like most significant, these very I don't know, but these very subjective word without like evidence. So that makes me think it's like it's more like the subjective opinion, solely based on the author's opinions. It's not like that's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point about style. So if you read any kind of textbook or any kind of writing on style, on academic style, any kind of theory, one of the key points is about this subjective versus objective type of style and what kind of words can be used and what kind of words are better to make the style more objective. So the objectivity of the academic style also has two main components. Has obviously your evidence, how much your text is supported by evidence, but also has the type of words that you use. And there are some words that are generally subjective words, like saying, for example, something is good, something is good, rather than saying there's a positive aspect of this is the following. Or something like, you know, words like normal, for example, that can be interpreted in various ways by readers. So there's quite a lot of writing on that kind of how to make your language more formal. But that's an interesting observation that, and I think part of the reason is also what you have to think about when you think about style is your audience as well. And if you look at, if you compare academic books which are written for purely an academic, very informed audience, and books, academic books still written by academics like this one, which are more intended for the wider public, with more general public, even though they contain, I mean, this book contains an academic study and data on those issues and evidence, it's kind of pitched more towards a wider public. The other element that's interesting, I thought it's interesting in this text here, it's also that it has an element of storytelling, and that's something, storytelling is a part of style, often discussed in academic writing as well, but it's really dependent on the conventions of your own discipline and also the requirements of your assignments. So often in some social sciences work, especially when scholars use methods like ethnography or very, you know, qualitative in-depth interviews, or the types of research where the researcher itself is involved in the fieldwork or involved in the topic in a certain way, like, you know, having different observations. So if you did a study about a certain, the charity sector, a certain part of the charity sector in the UK, and you yourself were involved in a way in that sector, and you observed people, you did interviews whilst you are involved in that way, then I think an element of storytelling can, you know, can be appropriate for academic writing, kind of arranging your argument to tell a story as well as to present the facts and evidence. Whereas in other disciplines that have more stricter rules, or if you do more articles and books with more quantitative methods, tend to have a more rigid style of presenting the evidence with fewer or no elements of this kind of storytelling that we're seeing here. But yeah, those are all good points. Gina says, I wish all my reading lists are like this. Yeah, it's actually quite a good book. I mean, even if you're not in the topic, it's quite easy to read, and it's quite interesting, even if you're not studying this particular topic. Okay, so let's go on and detail on some of those elements of style, drawing on the comments that you made, and we'll see how that goes. So the first thing that to remember and to be aware of when you're writing your essays and dissertations is where in the marking criteria can you find this style, this element of style, and often those elements of style are sorry, I just have to stop for 1 second because I think Damilare is joining. Just 1 second to hi Damilare. Okay, so continuing on the how does academic style fit in the marking criteria? Usually you have a criteria called something like, this is the UCL master's criteria, that's in a subject specific course called writing or communication, but there's usually a category about how you communicate your ideas. I'm not sure if Damilare can join. Okay, I tried again. Damilare, can you hear us? Let us know on the chat if you can hear us or... okay, I think it's fine now. The marking criteria usually include some kind of communication element, but often style is also mixed within presentation. So often markers will look both at the style of writing, the vocabulary you use, the clarity of your style, the way you adapt your style depending on the requirements of your discipline, but also your specific assignment. But other times there will be also included in, also assessed, the style will be assessed with other elements such as grammar, word choice, and how comprehensible the text is as well. So if you look at here on this, this marking criteria here, you want to get something that's obviously excellent or outstanding. So it's all about the style and the word choice showing fluency. Of the most exceptional work, here it says reads as if it's professionally copy edited. So it reads like as if it was published in a book or an article that's good in its style. But usually to get over 70% or in that range, the style is all about how the ideas flow and also the appropriate word choices in your work. So now that we have seen the marking criteria and how style fits in that, and usually, you know, that was just the point to say that style is often considered alongside other things. So it's not necessarily a tick box in itself in marking. It's kind of considered alongside other things like grammar, punctuation, alongside, how comprehensible your text is, alongside sometimes illustrations and other things that go into the marking criteria. So what are the common mistakes in academic style that markers see. I thought about my kind of experience as a marker and what I see. Damilar is trying to join and I'm getting distracted by the by the chat. Okay, so what are the common mistakes in academic style? And I try to categorize again the most common ones that I find as a marker, but doesn't mean there are no other ones that also could be discussed about. But those tend to occur regardless of whether you're writing something that has a more scientific style or something that has, is more within social sciences and has perhaps a clear element of storytelling. Also, what's important to mention when thinking about style is that the style really follows what's called the scientific method. So we discussed in previous sessions all those things about structure, arguments, and the style has to fit with those other elements of academic writing and scientific methods that you use as a whole. So what are the common mistakes that apply regardless of the discipline or regardless of the type of work that you do? So we're not speaking about very subject-specific style requirements now. So what's very common and very easy to do, even if you think that, you know, you haven't done that, it happens in my work as well, is to have English that, you know, if you're studying in writing in English, English that's quite informal. So often when we write, we think our arguments, you know, in our head, and then we write them, and it depends how our vocabulary was shaped as well. That kind of translates to what we're writing, and often we write something that's a bit more informal, but then we edit it, we make it a bit more formal, and that's fine. But sometimes we don't really realize whether we used a language that's too informal, because we think that's fine and that's a common use of language. What's the good news here? Avoiding informal words and colloquial phrases in academic writing, so that's kind of a ground rule. But the good news here is that most informal words in English actually have some equivalents in formal language. So some examples, something that's, good. Good is quite a subjective word, can be written as a positive aspect or something like that. Saying something, well, this argument is, this author is great. This study is wonderful, a wonderful interpretation of this theory. This could be replaced with close equivalents that actually, actually say what you want to mean, that something perhaps is an important interpretation or, a crucial interpretation or something that's more formal. There are several things to consider here. There are several factors, there are several aspects to consider here. So often, usually all those more informal words that we use very commonly in English in our everyday speech, or if we wrote non-academic pieces of work, like if we wrote a novel or an academic or a novel or a non-academic piece of writing, like a newspaper article or something like that, or a blog, most of those could be replaced with formal words. Then very close to informal English, it's subjective words. So we saw how good, can be subjective depending on how you use it. A good argument, saying this author makes a good argument about this particular phenomenon. It's your, saying that it's a good argument, it's of course your interpretation based on the evidence you have seen and based on your own, on your own critical analysis of that particular argument. So it's important if you evaluate something to make sure that you, the marker is aware of the criteria by which you evaluated that. So an argument is perhaps important or perhaps more important than something, but in reference to what exactly? Because if you just say something it's good, or even with the formal word it's important, it's always considered in reference to something else. Now, linked to this is subjective words. So academic writing, as we have seen again and again in the previous sessions, is based on evidence, and the evidence is really the foundation of academic writing and the foundation of your argument and the way you express your arguments in your dissertation. I'll just stop for a minute because we have a question from Charlie, do you have a question? Because I saw you raised your hand.
Yes, Alexandra, sorry to interrupt. So about the subject, I have a question regarding the subjective words. So can I just say, in the end, because while I'm evaluating my points, I might like, because I'm, as the essay writer, I know what my limitations are. Can I say the limit, just say the limitation of this essay is, or of my research is, or should I change the wording?
Yeah, I mean, definitely if you're taking a, you know, a stronger argument or a position on a certain issue when you're evaluating a set of arguments, for example, or a set of studies, and you take a particular position on that, of course, outlining limitations is important. So the marker is aware that you thought about this in the first place and how to situate your evaluation in the context of perhaps other points of view in the literature, or perhaps in the context of those limitations. So you're right in that. I mean, subjective words are generally just at, you know, how you express those ideas. So subjective words and the overuse of subjective words is usually not recommended in academic writing, just because it has different interpretations. So for example, saying, I saw the, an essay a few days ago that included, it was something, a paragraph about employment or, you know, going back to work or something like that. And the student used a phrase saying, well, this person finally had a normal job. Now, you know, in different people's interpretation, a normal job can mean different things. And it's a subject, is an example of subjective word, because something being normal, as, you know, a normal practice, a normal cultural practice, or a normal job in that particular example, the student may have interpreted it in a different way than the marker would, and then you'll have, you'll get those comments on your essays or dissertations saying the classical comments, what do you mean by this? Can you expand further? So to avoid that, you know, try to avoid words that could be, you know, easily interpreted by markers or other readers of your work in a different different way. So there are several words like that. It's something when, you know, when you make a value judgment about something. So it's not only about, it's not about your argument, because you can have a very clear argument and very strong argument. There's dissertations with very strong arguments saying, I actually found something in my analysis that contradicts some previous literature. And that's fine, because you expand it, and, you know, the chances are is that you'll actually get more points for originality if you find something that's new and perhaps, you know, even contradicts some of the previous knowledge on this. And then you, of course, add your limitations. It's more about thinking about the words. When you read your work, thinking about, can, you know, is this meaning actually, is there like a shared understanding of this this word? Can the marker circle this word and say, actually, I don't know what you mean about this, or I have a different interpretation. The other thing that is kind of falls within this subjective kind of tone or words or terms category is the tone. And it's something that sound, you know, can sound quite trivial, but I often got to mark essays where the student was just very apologetic. So I read essays when there was like something like, I didn't have time to really think about this conclusion, or I didn't really have time to read this literature. I think, you know, you need to be, don't raise additional questions to the marker if you don't have to. Don't be apologetic in your essay or dissertation. You can say something like, well, a limitation is time and resources, as a general thing, because the dissertation is done in a very short time, and especially if that impacted your data collection, like now with the COVID situation, for example, a lot of essays, you know, a lot of work is affected. So there's limitations of how the situation outside you can also impact your work and your ability to do the work that you planned. But yeah, don't be apologetic. I mean, you do your best to do what you can within the time frame, within the resources you have, and yeah, just present your arguments without having an apologetic tone, because you want to sound confident and sound like your essay is good and you thought through your arguments. And then the other thing that falls again within this subjective or more like normative kind of character of some essays is when some essays or dissertations try to tell the reader, i.e. the marker in this case, what to think. So let's say you did an argument about a certain policy. Let's say I work on immigration policy myself, and I did a study about how immigration, a particular immigration policy affects a group of people. Let's say I work a lot in my other work on family members coming to the UK to join their families. So, you know, in an academic essay, of course, I present my argument. I can have a very strong argument. I can say this policy is negatively affecting those people, and I can have the arguments for which this is negatively affecting those people if that's my argument. But then often essays or dissertations go, you know, overly generalized and try to tell the reader what they think, in the sense of using things like, you know, we should all do this, or we should all think about this, or we should all, like, should do something. And it's quite difficult to incorporate something that's very prescriptive, telling the reader what to do, unless you have a very strong argument that cannot be dismantled by an alternative interpretation. So yeah, do try to avoid telling the reader what to think about a particular issue, because the reader and your marker in this case will assess the work based on the evidence and your argumentation, and they can make their own mind up about what they think about the work. Then something that was raised by that was raised in the beginning of this seminar, when we looked at the differences between academic and non-academic style, is one of the common mistakes is the incorrect use of specialist terms, or misplaced specialist terms. So of course, make sure, you know, everyone tries to make sure you're familiar with the terms in your area of research, and use them correctly. And it's quite, as we have heard earlier on in the seminar, it's quite challenging sometimes, especially if we speak about very complex concepts or issues under study. The thing that I would say, I won't say that it's completely like, no, you can't do that, you can't use that, but be cautious. Is don't overuse very big words or terms if you actually don't engage with the literature on this. So one very famous word that is overused, I think, in a lot of essays is this idea of discourse. Well, discourse has different connotations and different, you know, there's different theories on discourse, on the use of discourse, there's different applications of discourse, and there are many authors who wrote on this. But often when you have an essay that just uses discourse without referring to any of those theoretical or empirical debates, then the marker may think, well, actually, you know, the student hasn't really read any of the work on the use of discourse, and they just use the word discourse just for the sake of using it. So for example, if you just want to say, well, there are some, you know, political narratives, for example, they don't have to be political discourses unless you actually mean it in the sense that the discourse is conceptualized in literature. You can use a simpler word, like a common English word, like still a formal word, like a political narrative, for example, because that won't raise the questions to the marker if you actually have engaged with a literature, which is a very specific topic. So always think, when you use big words like, you know, in the postmodern era, have you actually engaged with what, you know, what was written about postmodernism, or do you just use that to show that to put some good, you know, nice words in? If you don't actually engage with the literature and you don't, yeah, want to include that's fine. If it's just a time reference, you can just use a simpler way to express it, saying, well, you know, in this particular year or in this particular period of time, without necessarily using words, concepts that you haven't engaged with. So this is something just to be aware. I'm not saying you can't, definitely can't use it. It's just that markers often question whether you actually did engage with those terms or not. So before we move on to the next thing, Gina has a question. Please, Gina.
Yeah, my question is actually on the subjective words. I was thinking about it. And I think I quite don't understand the difference of having a logical and strong, confident argument, and a difference between that and telling the reader what they should think. Mm. Because having a strong argument, I think it's by nature persuasive. And then how would you describe the difference between the two?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And that's why it's an element of style, because it's not the content that you express, it's how you put it in writing. So in the example that I said earlier, let's say, for example, that I analyze how how family reunion policies affect migrants in the UK. That's something, a topic that I studied. And if my argument is that here are several ways that this policy affects negatively, and I would argue that the policy should be changed based on the evidence that it negatively impacts people, I can obviously say that. I could say that, you know, one policy implications from this argument that just put forward a strong argument saying though this policy negatively impacts this group of people, then I could say that one of the policy implications is reviewing the policy or changing the policy or just getting rid of the policy altogether. So it can be very strong in that sense. It's the style difference is when you address the reader directly or you use the we should do that. So I can say, one policy implication of my study resulting from my findings is that we should fundamentally change our way of dealing with this particular thing. And by saying we should do that, I involve a collective. So perhaps the reader doesn't necessarily agree with me. So try to make the argument less personal. So you're completely right. You can do have a strong argument. It's mainly about the word choice. And that's kind of, I think it also depends a bit on your particular discipline, because I worked mainly in political sociology, and political sociology has, you know, a lot of dissertations in this. You can be a bit more personal with the language. So I do, you know, I know there's some academic books and writing guides saying you should never use I. In the methods that I use, for example, when I do very in-depth interviews, my colleagues who do ethnography, we do use personal pronouns, not excessively, but when you explain a particular thing that you did, and when you think about your positionality as a researcher and potential biases, I think sometimes you have to use that. But it's all about this, it's all about the word choice, thinking, can I make it more impersonal? And sometimes you can't, and we'll look in some detail later on about the times when you can't make it more impersonal. Generally it's that trying not to be too prescriptive to what people should do. You can say, well, this particular thing is wrong. It can be reviewed or something like that, but yeah, try not to personalize the debate too much. So yes, it's choosing different ways to say that particular argument. So the other thing that is quite a common mistake in the style is having vague or unclear writing. So this is about generalizations that we spoke about in previous sessions as well. So try to refrain from using generalizations. Be as specific as you can. So often I see in essays phrases like, you know, commentators say, politicians say, scholars say, and then the immediate thing that the marker will ask is which commentators, which scholars, what type of politicians from which party, all of them, you know, how many of them. So to avoid those kind of questions, it's important to be very clear in your writing and clear about how you're referring to. So if you say, for example, I don't know, like politicians have said that this particular policy is wrong or is not doesn't have a positive effect on this population, then of course, you know, not everyone in politics has said that, so the marker will definitely write a comment and say, please be more specific. Whom are you referring to? Yeah, vague references as well. Things like, you know, in the current day, you can always be more specific. If I do a study in 2018, for example, when I did my PhD, fieldwork, I can say, well, this is relevant for this year or this particular period. If you study a particular period in history, let's say I study a particular phenomenon between 1960 and 1980, then mention that specifically if your time reference or a space reference is specific. Things like, you know, if I say something like, well, in West European countries or in the Western world, but my examples really only speak about Germany, you know, why not use Germany and then say, well, there are perhaps some implications or similarities in other West European countries, but don't overly generalize unless you actually do have several examples. So if I'm really referring to the UK case, I can't really generalize and saying like, you know, in the Western world, this happens. And it's a very easy mistake to make, because, you know, we often in our everyday speech and conversations, we do generalize things. What's really, I mean, related to that and very important, and I think this helps quite a lot when I realized this in my academic writing style, is that there's no one specific, there's different types of style, and different types of style can apply to different parts of your dissertation. And I will explain in a minute what each style does and how is it different. But the important thing is to know what kind of style is appropriate for what kind of text and even part of the text, especially in longer pieces of work. So there's a style that is descriptive. So you remember when we spoke about arguments and note-taking, saying, well, it's better to be analytical than descriptive when you analyze your literature, when you make your arguments, and avoid being overly descriptive of just describing what the literature said instead of critically analyzing it. But a descriptive style can be appropriate for particular parts of the text. And indeed, some parts of the text do actually require a descriptive style. For example, some introductions in dissertations have a very short background or context, especially if the topic is not something that's common knowledge or widely known. So perhaps, you know, a few sentences of background knowledge or context are included in some dissertations, especially in social sciences. Also, a descriptive style comes in quite useful when you simply describe methods. So if you do an experiment and you just want to describe the steps you took for that experiment, or if you want to describe how an interview protocol went in practice, you can't really be too analytical about that, because it's just simply stating the facts of what you did and being descriptive. Same when you have maybe a couple of sentences summarizing something, and then after that, in the next sentences, you can be more analytical or critical about that. But often a few sentences, even in the literature review, some sentences will be in nature descriptive. When you simply describe, let's say, I say that, you know, this particular study is relevant to understand this particular concept, and this is what the study found. And then I could add another sentence with my critical interpretation and trying to criticize that or put it into wider context, but the couple of sentences before will be descriptive. But make sure that, I mean, from your reading, when the marker is the reading, that it's clear that what you're describing is actually relevant. So, you know, when, for example, I see in an introduction or context kind of part of the essay, and I read some descriptive paragraphs about a certain case study, for example, or introducing a case study, then I can see as a marker, well, that is, you know, that is relevant for me to understand the further writing. But if the marker looks at it and thinks, well, what does this description have to do with anything that is discussed later on in the essay, then you may think again about whether to include that description. So the second style most parts of your academic writing is what's called an argumentative or analytical style. So that covers most of the writing, most of the dissertation. So when you're discussing your findings, when you're stating your argument, elaborating on them, when but it can also be mixed with those descriptive parts. So the example in the literature review, you can have a couple of sentences describing a certain finding, summarizing them, but also you can include a more analytical aspect of it when you situate that reading in the wider context, or when you criticize it, or when you put it into the wider context. But that's important to remember, that most of the academic writing, most of the parts of your dissertation will have a more analytical than descriptive style. In the theory, there's also an evaluative style, and that is particularly prevalent in essays, that in those types of essays where the tutor puts a question saying advantages and disadvantages of this thing. And then most of the essay will become evaluative in nature, although you also have an element of argument because, through it. But you also have evaluation within your dissertation. So for example, if you work on a topic where there are three main schools of thought and you adopt a particular theoretical position, the failure to justify, when you justify, why do I adopt, contact theory over conflict theory, then there's an element of evaluation because I evaluated why contact theories were more relevant for my dissertation than conflict theories, for example. And that includes and that involves being evaluative. So yes, it's in general when comparisons are involved. So I gave the example of comparing schools of thought or theories. Also, it's quite common when students discuss methods. So perhaps, I did an interview-based study, but I also could have had the option to have an ethnography. But I evaluated those methods and I came to the conclusion that in my dissertation, I will adopt an interview study rather than ethnography. And by that, when I explain why I chose one method over another, if I do that, then again, evaluation is involved. What's important to remember is, trying to assess, to address potential biases by checking, even if you make a strong argument, always checking the balance. Have I considered the other points of view? And if you choose one thing over another, make sure that the marker knows about the criteria you use. By this I mean, for example, if I considered, let's say, using two methods for my study, but I ended up using only one, it's not really enough to say I chose semi-structured interviews without justifying why I chose this method and not others. It doesn't have to be long. It can be just one short paragraph, but having some justification about why I use something and not others, especially if I use something that's not the mainstream, so to speak, within the literature. And now we come to a comment that was made earlier on, which is about, personal style. Personal style is discouraged in a lot of academic writing, especially in the more exact sciences. In social sciences, a lot of personal, there is an element of personal, the personal style. Of course, I recommend checking with your tutor because some specific guidelines for dissertations and essays will tell you not to use first pronoun, not to use I, for example, whereas others will be more flexible. But if you look at academic writing in general, some do include some personal style. One quite common example here is when you have a qualitative study. Let's say, I did interviews with this population, or I did participant observation, or I did conducted an ethnography. And then in most qualitative research, especially more currently, there's quite an emphasis on researcher positionality and how you reflect on this positionality in your own work if you're the researcher and you're involved in the topic and you may have different biases on the topic. And in that those particular sections of dissertations, it's quite common to have a few sentences that do use a personal style because you do describe how you position yourself as a researcher within the study. But yes, even if your discipline and your topic does allow this kind of more personal writing style, do be conscious about generalizing your personal experience, even if you do have this lived experience of the topic that you study. Okay, so now we have, before we go on to the summary kind of tips and then go to on the demonstrations, I just wanted to share like a few questions that, you know, it sounds quite simplistic, but they do really help you reflect. I think, you know, they did help me as a writer as well, reflect on my own writing. And that's, I mean, I call them Orwell's questions because they're from George Orwell's Politics and the English Language, when he discusses political writing and the mistakes in writing about politics at the time. And it's quite impressive that, you know, if you read this particular essay from Orwell, which was written in 1946 initially, a lot of it applies today. So it's really, yeah, it's interesting to see how some of the advice on writing style has stayed the same for, yeah, 100 years, so almost 100 years. So Orwell kind of has some questions in his essay. He says that every writer should address some questions. And those are four questions from his writing that I thought, you know, apply to everyone, regardless of what you're writing and what topic you're writing on. So the first thing, you know, he says, the first thing you have to ask is what I'm actually trying to say. And this may sound like an obvious thing. Of course, I know what I'm trying to say, but often everyone has felt when we're writing, you know, stuck in a paragraph and saying what I'm actually trying to say here. I actually don't know what exactly my argument is here. And this is the first key step, which is actually deciding on the content, deciding what you're trying to say. Then after you think what I'm trying to say this, this is my argument. The next question that comes in is what words would express it? And here's where you decide on style. What words are actually appropriate to express what I want to express? Should I use this word or is another word describing better what I want to express here? Even small things like when a lot of the literature review, a lot of the words are used saying, for example, this study shows, this study illustrated kind of common words. Sometimes you may want to nuance that a bit more depending on the context. Perhaps that study shed light on something that was not there before. Perhaps that study really emphasized something, or perhaps that study contradicted something. So using stronger verbs and stronger words, if that is the case, rather than the more generic ones that everyone uses. If you don't want to make a particular point and you just want to mention that particular study as part of the literature, that's fine. You can just use the more generic ones. But if you want to make a particular point about this, there are other words as well that will also diversify the vocabulary you use in your dissertation. The third, and I think this is the most important question that I still struggle when I write to think about this question. Could I put it more shortly? So I'm often reading a sentence or a paragraph. And this is, you know, making your style more economical. Let's say I wrote a sentence and I know what the content is. I know what kind of type of words, terms I want to include. Can I write this sentence in a shorter way? And almost always the shorter version will be clearer and easier to follow. And then Orwell also asks, have I said this? Those are quotes from him, by the way. Have I said anything that is avoidably ugly? And this is about making your style, as we discussed in the example, actually enjoyable to read. It doesn't mean it has to be entertaining, but often if you have like very complex constructions of words or very unclear sentence structure, it's actually not, you know, enjoyable or easy to follow to read, and you want to make the marker's life easier. So that is something to keep in mind for clarity and also making sure that it is easy to follow. Okay, so finally, before I go on to just showing you some of the tools that you can use and then going on to the abstracts, again, eight summary kind of thing, practical tips for improving your academic style. So just summarizing the conversation we had so far and some of the points from you as well, and including some others. So different disciplines have developed their own preferred styles. And this is important to keep in mind because sometimes you can have, you know, a colleague who wrote a very good dissertation in another discipline and adopted, let's say, used I or adopted a more personal style, and they still got an 80%, but then you would lose points because your discipline is more strict regarding how to use a more personal style or what type of style to use. Also, very connected to style are style guidelines. So a lot of universities actually have style guidelines, and those can include writing style, but also include the referencing style is include. It's kind of linked to this whole style criteria in the marking, although it's different from the writing style in itself. So then what we discussed in the slide, looking at different styles, it's finding the right balance and making sure that, you know, when you need a descriptive paragraph, the style that's used is descriptive, but actually when you need a more analytical paragraph or section of your writing, you don't use a descriptive style when you can use a more analytical style. Same ask about, you know, is there any part of my writing making an evaluation or a comparison about something? Or is my writing include anything more personal, like the example with ethnography that we looked at earlier? Just a very minor point, because it's very, very easy mistake to make, you know, avoid using contractions. So, you know, say do not, not don't, won't, you know, would not. That's just a very small observation, because it's very easy to not to do that. And avoiding informal language if you can express it in a more formal way. A very practical exercise to do, which I also do and some of my colleagues do, is after we write our drafts, we can highlight the bits of the text that use more informal language or even the words, and then read it again and think about whether we can rewrite some of those sentences with more formal formal language. Use clear language even when you speak about complex ideas. And I think that's, you know, easy to forget as well, because often we explain very complex concepts and we feel the need to use a very, you know, flowery language or overcomplicated sentence structures. I have to say that's also, I mean, what I'm saying here is from my experience and Mark's experience in the UK education system. So in my home country, for example, in Romania, in some educational settings, it's actually encouraged to have this overly complex, flowery language. So it really depends on the cultural thing as well. But, you know, as you're all studying within this particular context in the UK, I'm just advising on what would make the best grades here. But often if you study in the future somewhere else in a different country, those rules may be different. And if you, it's interesting to compare, especially if your discipline has, if you can find articles in your discipline on your topic from French journals or East European journals or journals in other countries, it's interesting to see the difference in style and structure, even when scholars write on a similar topic. So that's something just to keep in mind. So that's kind of UK academic writing style. So if there's a shorter word for the longer word that you use, then use the short one. That's one of the points on voice. Like, a lot of the questions are, should I use the passive voice or the active voice? The active voice is preferred if it actually makes sense in the context. That means, instead of saying something was done, it's the subject did that. Sometimes you do need to use the passive voice, but if you can use the active voice instead, it is preferred. When you're explaining concepts, complex concepts and arguments, it's usually best to use several examples to illustrate it, that especially if the concept is more complex. What is interesting from the home exercise that some of you have done is one of the observations I got from one of you who did the home exercise was that you liked that paragraph from that from the Ford and Goodwin reading, because the sentence structure was varied. So you have a shorter sentence with a sentence with a semicolon, and you had a sentence that was a bit longer. And often, of course, the advice is to avoid repetition in ideas and content, but also if you can make the sentence structure a bit more varied, it's also good to make the text more engaging and easier to follow. So instead of, you know, just kind of having a structure saying, you know, when you're reporting on the literature review section, for example, saying this study said this, this other study said this, it's better to perhaps vary a bit the sentence structure so it doesn't seem, even if the content is not repetitive, the structure doesn't seem too repetitive. But it's again something that's developed over time. It's not a must, you know, must have, but it's something that you want to think about when developing your academic style. Then the other thing that is linked to kind of overly complex language that, you know, in some countries is actually encouraged, but in the UK not so much, is in this context, educational context, it's important to avoid using jargon or foreign language phrases if there is a simpler English word. So in some works, you can't avoid that. So let's say if I do a dissertation in translation studies, or if I do an interview, let's say I interviewed for my PhD, I interviewed Romanian people in the UK. And sometimes when I translate the quote from their interview that I use in my data analysis, some words are just untranslatable. So obviously I will use the word and put into brackets the kind of closer equivalent in English for the marker to understand. But by this, by avoiding jargon or foreign language phrases when there's a simpler word, I mean kind of, you know, some dissertations just put in unnecessary like Latin words or I don't like kind of cliche expressions from French or German or other languages if they don't actually add anything. So just adding some Latin words wouldn't boost your mark, especially if they are out of context in that particular paragraph. So now we have about 20 minutes left. So we'll spend a few minutes just on showing those academic phrase banks. And then we will review a short abstract from the a dissertation. So often what the question, you know, what students want to know a lot of the times is, you know, what are the kind of expressions or particular phrases I can use for different purposes? And there are several academic phrase banks out there. Some universities have quite good ones on different topics. And some are free to view and some are, you have to pay, it's a paid software. So this RefnWrite is actually a writing software, so it has more features than only an academic phrase bank. But when you're writing in the software, you also can easily use those phrases from the phrase bank. So I will show you this and I'll show you a completely free one as well that may be helpful for you. I have to stop sharing and share the other screen. Okay, so that's the RefnWrite one. So it's a software, I haven't downloaded it because the software itself, I mean, you can have a free trial just to see how it works, but to have all the features, it's a paid software. But even if you don't download the software on the website, there are some, you know, there's a phrase bank and some writing ideas as well. So if you go, let's say, for example, you know, what's very important for originality, which is something Summer will discuss in the next seminar next week, is being able to show this research gap. So if I say, I'm not really sure how to phrase or how to even speak about my research gap. And you have different options. So, you know, how do I express the need for a better method? Or how do I express the need for more studies or the need for a better understanding? All those reasons why, you know, I can use to justify a research gap. And then I have some, you know, ones that I can access for free here. And if you get the full software, you can access many more of them. So you have those things called phrase templates. And if you have the software, it will open and you'll have them, you know, near the actual text, so you can easily use them. And you just have kind of examples of how to do those different things and how to phrase it in an academic style. And you have a lot of variation. Or if you are, for example, you know, you're not really sure about how to present statistics, how to introduce the significance level, for example, how to phrase that. You have again examples on pretty much every aspect. Even like, you know, I don't know how to write my acknowledgements in the dissertation. Again, you can, I don't know how to, you know, write my declaration in the dissertation and so on. There's things on pretty much everything. Very useful things on like figures or how to introduce figures in the text and things like that. So this is just something to, you know, you can think about if you think it will be useful for you. But they're also completely free academic phrase books. So this is the one I found from the phrase bank from the University of Manchester. So maybe check if your own university has something like this, but I found this quite comprehensive and quite good to include the range of things. And again, there's those kind of things that we always ask about how it's best to express this. If I click just as an example on being critical, you know, you can already see what kind of things you can do to be critical. So one thing I can do to be critical is to highlight inadequate previous studies, or identifying a weakness in a single study or paper, or introducing problems and limitations, or introducing general criticism. So let's say I want to say, how do I phrase, I identify the weakness in a particular study, how do I phrase that? And then again, I click on this, and I have plenty of examples, you know, that also ensures that you don't repeat your vocabulary, and you can just take it from here saying, you know, however, Smith fails to fully define what the main weakness of the study is, the failure to address how, and all those are very helpful because your ideas are there. It's just about developing the ways to express it. And after you practice and you kind of adapt some of those phrase books, then it will come also naturally. You know, when you express yourself in writing, you have all those phrases in your mind, and it will, you know, it will be effortless at some point after you practice more. So before I go on to the dissertation, I think Gina has a question.
So my question is, what is your personal thoughts as a marker of using the academic phrase bank, especially from the Manchester University? Because I once had one-to-one writing consult, like one-to-one writing coach from Academic Writing Center from UCL, and then the tutor thought my sentences were too wordy, but they were actually from the Manchester phrase bank. So I was confused.
Okay, so yeah, so I mean, this is just an example because different universities have different ones. That's why it's important to check the style with your tutor and your course. I wouldn't, you know, use this as just to kind of copy paste different structures. It's more to see the different variety of words. So, you know, for example, when a lot of, if just control F, like however, in all of the dissertations, you'll have like 200 of howevers. It's more of a case of how do I express that differently and take some inspiration in terms of synonyms and other things. But in terms of kind of conflicting advice, that's what happens a lot of the times, because if the advice on a specific assessment or a specific course conflicts with other advice. So maybe, you know, like the sociology essays in Manchester University may have very specific requirements compared to the UCL ones. So what we kind of discuss today in those seminars are kind of the general rules and principles and some resources you can use, but then it's also up to each university to have their specific requirements. And in terms of like sentences being too wordy, I'm not sure what they meant by that. You know, some a way around it is just to make the sentences less long, but this doesn't mean you can't use phrases. So I'm not really sure what the objection was there. I mean, personally, I don't, as a marker, I look at clarity, I look at the flow of the argument, and I look at the variety in the vocabulary as well. So, you know, if I find the paragraph saying, you know, with let's say six sentences and three of them start with the same, three of them start with furthermore and then the next one starts with furthermore and so on, then I would think, well, you know, there needs to be more diversity within the vocabulary. And I actually think having, especially for non-native speakers and for myself as well when I was in university, I think those are really helpful to actually develop the vocabulary, and then you can adapt it to your own writing. But I think to start with, you do need to look at some of those. Doesn't mean you have to completely adapt them, it's just to look at for some inspiration in the different words that you use. I think it's, you know, those are useful, just even if you don't use the exact phrases, even if I just don't copy this, it's also thinking about different criteria and seeing what actually is needed. So especially on this thing about being critical, for example, you can see kind of what things the marker would look at, like limitations on methods, limitations on theory, and so on. So even if it just gives you like a general guidance, that's still, it's just something that you have to use this resource. And obviously, yeah, as I say in all those seminaries, I think you have to check with your, you know, in your module handbook or assignment if there's any kind of guidance on that. Let's move on to, because we have 10 minutes left to see that dissertation and the abstract. Okay, so we have an MA dissertation again, which is in literature and film, and we're going to focus on the abstract, so we can focus on something specific, so we can speak about, because some of you asked about the abstract structure. Most dissertations will require an abstract, probably all of your dissertations will require a short abstract, so let's look at the structure of the abstract and the style of the abstract as well. Okay, so that's the dissertation here. So Reflections on Dear Amir, that's a film study of literature and film adaptation from an intercultural perspective. So before we look at this in more detail at this particular abstract, what do you think, I mean, if anyone wants to comment, what do you think are the main components of an abstract? What do you have to include in your dissertation abstract? Anyone wants to comment or write on the chat? So what are the kind of main components in the abstract? Okay, so we have Gina on the chat saying research questions, methods, findings, and limitations. So Damilaria, do you want to comment as well?
Well, good afternoon, everyone. The components of an abstract is just a summary of each of the sections, just one sentence of the sections.
So summarizing the findings, right?
Yes. Just like a one sentence of each of the sections of the whole essay or dissertation.
Okay, yes, that's definitely, you need to include this summary of findings. So generally speaking, again, some specific disciplines have abstract templates for dissertations, but generally, of course, the findings are the key thing in the abstract. But the abstract usually has, I mean, it starts with one sentence, kind of just announcing the topic and why the topic matters, you know, why the topic matters to be studied in the literature. Then quite a lot of the abstracts have a second component, which is just briefly summarizing the key issue that they're looking, that the dissertation is looking at, or the research question. So a lot of the abstracts will be, okay, this is a study about this particular phenomenon, this is why it is important in this particular context. The research question looked at is the following, or the study explores whether this, you know, relates to this, or kind of incorporating the research question within the text. And then most abstracts have one sentence about the methodology used. So most abstracts have something like this study adopts an experimental study and giving a bit of detail on that, or this study adopts a qualitative methodology and, you know, including 60 interviews with those populations, or this study is based on a survey research including 2000 participants. And then the main point, the bulk of the abstract, as Damilaria was saying, is summarizing the findings very briefly. But then it's also a question about how much of the findings you want to give away from the start. So obviously you can't go on to everything. And in more scientific papers, it's very common to say, I mean, actually it's advised to say exactly what the findings are in the abstract. Whereas in some of the social science abstracts, in some of the articles you are reading, there is some element of findings, but there's also an element of surprise that you find perhaps other findings in the findings and discussion. Whereas in the scientific papers, it's more about a summary of, yes, I ran those experiments and those were the results and there's the significance of the results. Finally, I think as Gina said on the chat, there is also an element of limitations to some abstracts. You don't want to overplay the limitations to say there are too many limitations, but you can also have a sentence that kind of incorporates limitations and further research, saying, well, that's, you know, this is how this literature, how the study contributes to this particular literature. But what is often missing from abstracts that I advise that you include, especially in research dissertations, it's what is the original contribution of your study. It's very important for, you know, any PhD, but also I think it's important for master's degrees where you do your own research, whether that's your own interviews, experiments, and so on. Because in that way, the marker will be able to say, to tell from the beginning of your thesis when they read the abstract, okay, that's my contribution. So you can say, well, this study contributes to this particular literature, or this study, yeah, what is the original contribution of this study? Very few dissertations comparatively, who, you know, some dissertations have wider implications outside academia. So for example, if you are doing a dissertation in business studies, it may have some implications for, you know, different companies you're researching, or, you know, in my case, my dissertations had its implications for policy making. You may also want to include a very, very brief sentence about kind of non-academic implications, if there are any, but most of the dissertations won't have. There will be, the contribution will be how the study contributes to the literature, to the academic literature and scholarship and research on that particular issue. In general, abstracts are, some of your handbooks will have a specific structure and will tell you the abstract has to be 150 words or 300 words. In general, the abstracts range between 150 and 300 words in the vast majority of dissertations, but do check that, because that may be an extra, a specific requirement for your course. So let's look at finally at this this abstract here. So the abstract says there are multiple relations between literature and film. By discussing how to understand cinematographic adaptation correctly and illustrating the complexity of such issues, how novels and films combined and differed from each other as two different kinds of arts is becoming a worthy controversial topic. So again, like what we observe in the first sentence, I'm just kind of voicing my thoughts if I were a marker for this. So the first sentence is quite vague. I mean, there are multiple relations between literature and film, of course, but what, you know, what does that mean? So perhaps the first sentence would be better by replaced by saying why this relation between literature and film in this context is worth studying. Then the second sentence, as you have seen, it's, you know, it's a bit quite long, and it, you know, it got a bit quite confusing. So again, the sentence I would think about as a marker, like, you know, the sentence could have been split or be a bit clearer in its style. Then the third sentence becomes a bit clearer because it actually starts saying what this dissertation is going to discuss. So it's saying the dissertation discusses the complex relation between literature and film, and from the cross-cultural perspective due to the changes of present in visual culture by reflecting with my own short film, Dear Amir. So again, it's important to kind of just, you know, get to the point quite quickly in the abstract. So I would say, have a sentence saying, okay, that's my topic. I'm researching this relation between the literature and film. This is why it's important. This is my research question. And this is the method that I use. And then those are my findings. Also, what I observed in this abstract as well is that there's a mix between more personal and formal style. So if you're going to, you know, either adopt, so this kind of dissertation, it's a bit, has a more personal style because the student actually produced a short film for her degree. And then this dissertation is also, it's also a reflection on this own, on this creative piece. So in this case, it's quite common to have a more personal style. However, don't mix and match the style. So if you're going to say, you know, if you're going to use saying like, you know, I'm using my own thing or that's what I do, then, you know, then it gets quite formal saying then the author further discusses. So you either use personal style if your topic and discipline allows it, or you use this more impersonal style saying the author or this dissertation discusses that. Again, when I look at the abstract as a marker, so it ends with a final finding. So it says lastly, so it's one of the final findings in the final section of the dissertation. So what in terms of kind of style and like the style of your abstract, I would always add a final sentence that's either something about limitations, something about limitations or something about implications or something about the contribution of your study towards the wider literature or wider world in general, depending on the implications of your study. So I will send, I'm aware that we ran out of time, so I don't want to hold everyone for too much longer. And I will send this dissertation to you as well with the notes and everything else as, and the recording, notes, the recording and the dissertation as usual. So I'm just checking if there's anyone else who said anything on the chat. Okay, no, then just to mention that next week will be about originality and this aspect that we discussed from the abstracts, stating your original contribution in the abstract or very early on in your thesis will be something that will be discussed more by Summer next week when she will be looking at how to prove to the marker that your arguments are original and how to be able to demonstrate the contribution to the literature and to and wider implications if that's the case in your dissertation. So just that's just a mention that next week will be with Summer, who's another PhD researcher. Now I'm aware that we kind of ran out of time, but if there's anyone who has any kind of last burning questions, is there anyone else who has any final questions before? Okay, so I don't see any hands up and I think I did answer everything on the chat. So, I mean, great. So I will send all the materials in a few hours as usual. And there's something on the chat. Thank you all. Thank you all for your contributions. The other thing to mention is that if anyone wants me to use any of their own essays in those demonstrations at the end or within discussion, you can send some essays and I will anonymize them and we can use them in the class as well if you want to get some feedback with on your own work in class, you can send me like a draft or something and we can use them to discuss particular findings. But I'm aware some, you know, in some cases you can't really send anything else unless it's submitted. So it generally just works with submitted essays. But it's just something to mention. And yeah, thanks everyone. Thanks for your contributions. And next week, looking forward to, it's quite exciting. We have another guest teacher after Anastasia and Kari. We have summer next week. And I hope everyone stays safe until next week.